Okay, good afternoon. Welcome back to everybody. I hope you've all had a good break, ready to go again. I'm going to actually change what I was going to do. I was going to actually be doing more talking this afternoon with, but I've decided we'll go for some imagery. Still be me doing a lot of talking, but there'll be just some more imagery to look at, so we'll approach it from that point of view. The subject that I was going to talk about, which was the three vehicles, the three Yanas, maybe we'll talk a little bit about that tomorrow morning. We still need to talk through that, but we will, we'll do that tomorrow morning now, instead of this afternoon. I know maybe a couple of you have done some classes with Andy Weber. And it's always very interesting to look at where the imagery has come from and where the whole kind of Buddhist philosophy fits into that category of Buddhist imagery, how the two kind of marry up. Because we're really, Buddhist art is not really art. It's Buddhist philosophy being expressed in pictorial terms. So I'm going to share a screen with you, if you've all got access. We're going to look at an image, firstly, of the Buddha, which hopefully you can all see on your screen there. From a Tanka painting point of view, this is the first image that we study. The face is the very first thing that we learn how to draw. We can spend weeks or even months repeatedly drawing the face, which basically kind of teaches you everything you need to know about line drawing, about drawing Buddha's form. And we then go to learning how to draw the body, and then which becomes the robed body with all the lotus and moon cushion as well. But starting with the Buddha's body. So there's a lovely story that at the time of the Buddha, there were two neighboring kingdoms. And the rulers, the kings of these two kingdoms, in an effort to kind of maintain cordial relations, would regularly offer each other gifts. And one day, one of the kings offered to the other a fabulous jewel, the like of which had never been seen before. It really was just this over-the-top piece of jewelry. And the recipient, king, was very pleased with his gift. However, he thought, now we've got a bit of a problem. How are we going to sort of repay this? How are we going to kind of match this in our next gift? So he actually called his council together of his ministers and said to them, look, you know, this is what's happened. This is what we've got. This is wonderful. But who's got any idea about what we can do to repay sort of this other king? So one of the ministers had been attending some of the teachings with the Buddha. And he said, look, the most precious thing we have in our kingdom at the moment is the Buddha. And obviously we can't offer the Buddha, but maybe we can make an image of the Buddha and offer that to the other king. And the king thought, yeah, that sounds like a pretty good idea. We'll ask the Buddha, you know, whether he'd be happy for that, whether he thinks it's a good idea. So they approached the Buddha, and the Buddha said, yes, great idea. Send along your court artist and he can make an image of me. So the artist went to visit the Buddha to make an image of him. But the Buddha was so radiant. Here we go, radiance. All the wavy lines coming out of the Buddha are actually light rays. And it kind of made the Buddha's outline very nebulous, and the artist couldn't really quite see what was going on. So he said, Buddha, I'm a bit of a problem. I can't really, you know, sort of see. And Buddha said, oh, yeah, sorry about that. He said, I can't help the light emanating. He said, if I float above this pool of water, then you can draw me from the reflection in the water. This image is what the artist recorded, and it's actually called the water reflection image of the Buddha, Chulenma in Tibetan. And you can see as part of the image, this grid, all these red grid lines, and they give the proportions of the Buddha's body. The grid lines are actually the measurements that the artist made, and they're all measured in finger widths. So for instance, around the eye here, you can see these horizontal lines, quite narrow. This is one finger width. Between the eyes and the nose here is four finger widths. All the sort of the different parts of the Buddha's body have these proportional measurements. And when you put them together, it's actually easier to see in this one, that the Buddha's body has these definite dimensions, the width of the waist, of the chest, the width of an arm, the length of the lower arm, the hand. Everything has a definite measurement. And this was basically the Buddha teaching the shape, size, proportion of his body, done as a teaching. So this grid, as we call it, and the image of the Buddha within it was taught by the Buddha. It was displayed, it was given by the Buddha to this artist. And it's been passed down generation to generation, down to the current day, so that we're still using the same grid now, 2,600 years later, as was recorded by that artist at the time of the Buddha. So this is an unbroken lineage. And it's the Buddha displaying all of the, you may have come across the major and minor marks. So it's things like the long earlobes, the lotus petal shaped lips, the shape of the eye being in the shape of a royal bow. All of these shapes and features are defined. They're sort of described, and in themselves are teachings. And this was the Buddha giving that teaching. And as I said, it was the skill of the Buddha in not only giving teachings orally, but it was the Buddha giving teachings through the medium of his body as well. And this was the way in which those teachings were recorded. So when we see an image of the Buddha, we're not just looking at a picture. We're studying a text on whichever subject from Buddhist philosophy. As also mentioned this morning, the effect of this is a direct transmission of non-conceptual wisdom. So whilst it's, here's the Buddha's right hand mudra, okay, let's get it on the other picture on here. This is called the earth touching mudra. So normally you don't have this red line, that's a grid line, but his middle finger is just touching the moon cushion just in front of him. And sometimes we call this the earth witness mudra. And it was it's the Buddha's demonstrating his overcoming of delusion and Mara, the demons, as they were called. So whilst we can understand that on an intellectual level, equally, we don't have to. It might help us to understand intellectually, and if so, great, understand it intellectually. But equally, if you don't want to spend years studying the iconography of the form of the Buddha, you can just gaze upon it. As I said this morning, just if you can't do anything else, just gaze upon an image of the Buddha, and all these teachings will be imparted directly to your mind. We receive blessings, our minds become positive and peaceful, and very beneficial just to look at an image of the Buddha. And it's so all of this is true of basically any of the holy images. Any image of an enlightened being carries a similar sort of story to it. And the reason I start to say this is because if we go back to our mandala that we looked at this morning, which was the White Tara mandala, and we said that in the center here is the deity. And I think it makes sense that we look actually a little bit at the deity. So here is Tara. Some of you may recognize this from Land of Joy. This is actually a reworking of a painting I did for Land of Joy a few years ago, of White Tara. This is a more modern copy, digital copy. On the mandala, we're looking at the seed syllable. This is the Tibetan letter Tam. The bit that looks like a five is the Tibetan letter Ta, and the little circle at the top is the sound. So this is Tam, and it's Ta for Tara. This is like we say seed syllable, but it's like a symbol, really, for the whole of the deity. Instead of having to draw and paint the whole deity, we can look at the seed syllable. But this is the image of Tara that would fit into that central position in a mandala. I just found this one. This is by my teacher, Andy Weber. This is the mandala of Chenrezi Avalokiteshvara, appearing in his 11-faced version. So you've got your 11 faces up here and only eight arms, not the thousand-armed version. But you can see here the deity is actually drawn and painted in the center of the mandala. So I'm just going to come back to there. So I don't really want to make this specifically about Tara. It's only an example. Just happens to be a mandala that I have a decent copy of to show you, as well as having the painting of the actual deity as well. So we don't particularly need to go into specific symbolism of White Tara, but it's to illustrate the position of the deity in the mandala, always in the very center. As far as I know, I've never seen it anywhere else in a mandala. It's always in the very center. And this goes along with this principle that we said about this morning of basically being the center of our own universe, is the same with the deity, occupies the central position. So this kind of brings us on to a little bit of kind of background again. Because in order to understand why we should visualize deities and mandalas, we need to look at the methods that are employed on the Vajrayana path. So we will look a little bit at why we would visualize ourselves in the form of deities and occupying a pure realm as a mandala. So in the three turnings of the Wheel of Dharma that we mentioned, talked quite extensively about this morning, you remember that there are different grounds and different paths that we follow in each of the three turnings. And they kind of equate to what we call the three vehicles, the three yanas. And they each have their own set of skillful means, methods by which we realize the fruition, the fruit of each of the three vehicles as we sort of progress on the path. So there's this, again, emphasis on ground, path, and fruition. In the tantric path, which we also call Vajrayana, we also call secret mantrayana. They all mean the same thing. That one of the most effective, skillful means is that we visualize ourselves as a deity and our environment as a perfectly pure environment in order to stop ordinary conception. So we talked this morning about how we view our current ordinary sort of experience as being ordinary. And this is part of the problem, that if we see ordinary and we believe it to be ordinary, it becomes a cause of suffering. In the Vajrayana path, we talk about ordinary appearance and conception as being the root of suffering. This is kind of the ground or the view of the Vajrayana, that if we see our world as ordinary and we believe it to be so, this is the cause of our suffering. So this is the ground. The Vajrayana employs many skillful means. And in fact, one of the other names of Vajrayana is the path of skillful means. I mean, it's also known as this. But we have a set of skillful means by which we stop ourselves from believing our ordinary appearances to be ordinary, that overcomes ordinary conception. But also we train so extensively in seeing ourselves as a deity and our environment as being a pure environment, that eventually even our ordinary appearances transform into a pure appearance. So the methods that we employ of transforming ourselves into a deity in imagination to begin with, of seeing ourselves and believing ourselves to be a deity, is a means to an end to bring this ordinary appearance and conception to an end. In doing so, we allow our Buddha nature that we talked about this morning, this inherent potential, this perfectly pure level of our being, to manifest by really blocking everything that is obstructing it from manifesting its own purity. So it's a very skillful, very particular set of methods that are presented in the tantric teachings But it's a very different idea to either really of the first two turnings or vehicles. So we refer to the path of the first turning, we normally call the Hinayana. I like to translate that as foundation vehicle. And the second turning we normally refer to as the Mahayana, the great vehicle. And these two we refer to as being causal paths. They create the causes for enlightenment. But in the Vajrayana, which is one of the ways in which we can practice the third turning teachings, we refer to this as a resultant vehicle or an effect vehicle. Because what we're doing, instead of starting at the ground and working upwards, which is quite a struggle, we actually imagine that we're already on the top floor of the building. And it's kind of a psychological trick in if we convince ourselves strongly enough that we're at the top of the building, the rest of us will kind of catch up and kind of say, oh, we're at the top of the building. And it's a very, very skillful, very, very effective method that is imagining the result to be right here, right now. There's an absolute need for us to be convinced that this is reality. We're not just pretending. Even though, especially when we first start these sort of practices, it's very much done in our imagination. But we really have to be convinced that it's a method by which we can achieve the result, and that that result is available to us right here, right now. So another way that we describe the Vajrayana is the lightning vehicle, because things happen or can happen so quickly. The causal vehicles, when we rely on creating causes for enlightenment, it's said to take just an uncountable amount of time. They say, uncountable. They actually say three countless great eons, which according to one Sanskrit scholar is a number with 27 zeros on the end of it. I don't even know what billion, trillion, zillion, gazillion, whatever the word is. I don't have no idea. That's a long, 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 long time. It's doable. It's possible. And the Buddha did it himself. So we practice the six perfections and we meditate on emptiness for three countless great eons in all of our births through that period, during which we're constantly creating causes for enlightenment and meditating principally using inference, logic and reasoning as presented in the Perfection of Wisdom Sutras and Nagarjuna's shastras, treatises on emptiness and the commentaries, great commentaries given by people like Chandrakirti and Jetsongkhapa, among others, that we use logic and reasoning to establish the view of emptiness and to eventually realize emptiness. But this takes a very, very long time. In the Vajrayana, then we are able to accumulate merit and wisdom in a much more direct and powerful way, meaning that it's actually possible to achieve enlightenment within the space of one short human lifetime, which is nothing compared to three countless great eons. So we look at maybe the greatest example of all in the Tibetan literature is Milarepa, who started from a point where he had committed murder. So he was in a very sort of a low starting position, shall we say, but through complete devotion to his teacher and complete diligence and effort, given to his the practices that his teacher gave him, that he managed to achieve enlightenment in one short human lifetime. So the difference between causal vehicles and resultant vehicles is spectacular. I'm saying we really need to be convinced that this is possible and that this is what is actually happening when we do these meditations. So to enter the path of Vajrayana, we need empowerment. So this is given by a teacher who we regard as having successfully completed his practice or her practice, and that we are receiving a living transmission of methods and teachings that will lead us to the same state. There is a very big emphasis on having faith and trust and devotion to the teacher from whom we receive tantric initiation. And yet another way of describing the Vajrayana is the path of devotion or the path of blessings. We say that all attainments come through our faith, devotion, and blessings. So the more that we can connect with that level, the easier our path becomes. We might ask, why is this so? Well, it comes back to this idea of Buddha nature. So we have this inherent potential with us, within us, Buddha nature. We have this perfectly pure mind that is empty, but having this luminosity, this awareness, this alive quality. And actually the guru, the lama, the teacher with whom we establish a connection on the tantric path really is a reflection of our Buddha nature, and we should regard him or her in that way. So by regarding the teacher as being, maybe we could say, a fully enlightened being who has completely realized their own Buddha nature, we're allowing this recognition to draw forth our own Buddha nature, that it kind of pulls it up by its own bootlaces, if you like. And this, I'm going to just come back to, I realize I'm still on the screen share, but that's what these images are about. Okay, this is one way in which these images work for us, in that we should regard these as kind of looking in a mirror. This image, whether it's Buddha Shakyamuni, Waitara, Chenrezig, Manjushri, doesn't matter which holy being we're regarding, we should regard them as being reflections of our own Buddha nature. This is us. This is me. This is you. It's like we're looking in a mirror. This isn't an external being. This isn't certainly not a drawing of an external being or a painting. This is our Buddha nature manifested, in this case, onto a screen or a sheet of paper or a bit of canvas. But it's a method by which our Buddha nature can ripen and manifest. And this is how this way of even just gazing upon an image of the Buddha, how it works, is that it awakens our potential. And if we have a teacher with whom we have a strong connection, and we regard them as an actual Buddha, as an actual enlightened being, then that provides a possibly even more powerful way that our innate Buddha nature responds to that connection. And through the blessings of the teacher, our Buddha nature ripens, and we might say progress along the spiritual path. So the same thing is what happens in meditation. So when we meditate on ourselves in the form of a deity, again, it is directly contacting our Buddha nature and encouraging it to bloom, to grow, to manifest, to ripen, whichever words, they're just words. But this is what is happening. Meditate on the form of a deity and on the mandala. Ooh, lots of things going on there. Because we always talk about self and other. Yeah. We have what we regard as being us, and we regard everything else around us as being other than us. So we don't just need the deity, we need the mandala to reflect that duality of self and other. By meditating on ourselves as the deity, we're principally purifying ourselves. In meditating on the mandala, we're principally purifying our experience of the world around us. This, we mentioned this morning, this totality of experience. So this is where the meditations on the deity and the mandala really come alive. Not just something to be done on the cushion, that's where we do our training. But of course, we might have 23 hours of the day where we're not sat on a cushion. We have to deal with career and family and paying the bills and breaking down on the motorway and all these things. And by meditating on the mandala, we're able to transform our experience, everyday experience, into the enjoyments, activities, experiences of an enlightened being. So we can respond with all the qualities of enlightenment, of love and compassion and patience, instead of attachment, aversion, jealousy, pride, ignorance, all these negative ways of responding. We're able to tap into the positive qualities that are part of our Buddha nature. All the enlightened qualities are already part of our Buddha nature. They're not something to be learnt later on. They are all there, complete within us. That's just very much part of our Buddha nature. But of course, at the moment, they're obscured. They're hidden. We can't tap into them. We might get the odd brief glimpse of what it is to be loving and compassionate and patient. And we get these really through just brief flashes of this innate potential within us. And we can say our training, we might sort of meditate on developing patience. Well, the patience isn't coming really from outside of us. What we're doing is allowing that quality to be released from our Buddha nature, to be sort of come to the surface a little bit more. So in meditating on the deity and the mandala, we are helping our Buddha nature to develop, to manifest. And it's one of the very many skillful means presented in the tantric path, in the Vajrayana path. There are others, which probably we won't go into today. And I'm not really here to teach tantra either. That's something for another time. But it's really to try to give you the idea of using a mandala. You know, we might have had a tantric practice maybe for many years, and we may be meditating on the form of the deity and the mandala around us. But maybe we're not being able to bring that experience into our daily life. So hopefully we can begin to sort of see how we can start to bring those experiences into just our daily life when we're not in a formal session. And maybe we'll look more at that tomorrow. But I think from here, let's start to have a look at some of the features of the mandala. Let me just stop that screen share just for a second. And actually, are there any questions so far? Because I'm kind of going to move on. Anybody got any questions? No? Okay. So let's bring the screen share up again. And so, symbolism of the mandala. So quite often, Buddhist teachings, we find different interpretations and different reasonings and different explanations given by different teachers at different times. In the Tibetan tradition, this has given rise to what we normally call the four main schools of Tibetan Buddhism, the Nyingma, Shakya, Kagyu, and Gelug schools. And they all teach the Buddha's words, they all teach the same material, but they might offer different insights gained by meditators in their own sort of unique style, in their own meditations. So there are some differences in explanation. And if I give you an explanation of a mandala, a symbolic, you know, sort of iconographic description of what things mean in a mandala, the chances are you're going to hear something different from somebody else. It's almost definitely going to happen. And I want you to be aware of that. And there is no sense of one being right and one being wrong. It's merely different interpretations. We've already established that the ultimate truth is beyond words and beyond the intellect. So in trying to use words, we're setting ourselves up for failure. Really, we're trying our best to impart something that just can't be said in words. And of course, at different times, different meditators or yogis have had their own direct experiences. So one meditator may see a particular deity with, say, a flower in his right hand, and another meditator may see him with a vase in his right hand. Doesn't mean to say that one's right and one's wrong. It just means that there are slightly different forms of a deity. And there might be different explanations given. So even I've come up with some, it can either mean this or it can mean that. But I'm not going to try and go into too many controversies or differing explanations of parts of a mandala, because that can just be confusing. I will give you one explanation, and please just take it as being one explanation among many. If you've already heard teachings and what you hear from me is a little bit different, that's fine. If you later on hear something that's different to what I give you, again, that's absolutely fine. It may mean sort of one thing may mean more to you at one time than another, but actually they can both point towards sort of the same truth. So I need you to be very clear that this is not a definitive, this is the way things are. And yes, as I say, you may well hear other explanations at other times. So if we're okay with that, let's start looking at a mandala. So as an overview, we've already said we have the deity in the middle. Normally, the deity is seated on a throne. And in this particular case, we have this circular throne. It's a lotus throne with eight petals. And on these are the eight auspicious signs. Let's zoom in here. So we have the banner of victory, conch, the fish, victory umbrella, lotus, endless knot, treasure vase, and the Dharma wheel. So we have these eight auspicious signs. There are many others. If I do, sorry, I'm just looking over to phase screen for a moment. I'm going to try this. Yeah, look at that. This Zoom thing actually works. So this one is a work in progress. So on here, this is the throne section. So the central deity will be going in the middle, but there are all retinue deities, all in these lotus petals. I haven't done them yet. If we go back to this one as well, here we go. We have eight lotus petals, but this time we have four of the Dhyani Buddhas. In here, we've got Vairochana, Amoghasiddhi, Akshobhya, and Ratnasambhava. So we have different arrangements in different mandalas, but this is always where the deity in the middle, with some sort of throne arrangement around. And they're seated within a hall, really. So it's this inner square where my mouse pointer is going at the moment. This is kind of a hollow space, if you like, which is bounded by, here is a wall that is made of light, and it's five colored lights: white, yellow, red. This is green, quite difficult to see, distinct from blue next to it. So white, yellow, red, green, blue. Now, I said it's made of light, and this has made me think I really need to say everything's made of light. This whole mandala, all the deity, you as the deity, everything in the mandala, everything is as insubstantial as a rainbow. Or we say a reflection of the moon on a pond of water, or as a mirage. We have all these analogies for how this appears, but we can imagine everything to be made of light. So this reflects this quality of things being empty and yet appearing. Appearing and yet empty. So we're directly sort of bringing that basic view, that basic ground into our meditation. And it's absolutely vital, because what otherwise that we do, we swap clinging on to an inherently existent self as being me, Ray. I just swap that for being clinging on to an inherently existent self who I'm going to call White Tara. Okay, if I believe this White Tara to be kind of having some concrete existence, then I'm just swapping my delusion, my ignorance from one object to another. So we have to bring this quality, the emptiness quality, into our visualization and our understanding. None of this exists other than as purely insubstantial entity, completely empty in nature. And yet, it appears. We have to remember this at all times. So, how much do I give you? So this five-colored light wall, okay? If we were to stand inside this hall and look around us, we'd basically see a blue wall all the way around. But actually, it's made up of these five lights. And we see that it goes round. Let's do the top one because it's easier to do this. It goes all the way around this kind of vestibule sort of area. This is kind of a doorway. And there are four doorways, north, south, east, and west. And just to orientate you, this is always west. What would be the top, what you might call the top of the mandala, is always the western direction. It's because the deity is looking this way, kind of looking down, as it were. And this is because this is east. This is the rising sun. This is the dawning of wisdom. So the deity is always facing east. So behind them is west. So if this is west, then the other direction is just follow as normal. This would be north, this east, and this south. So this sort of square section here are the walls of the palace. And actually, if I go over to another image, which I've just got to find. There we go. Right. So this doesn't show you really hardly anything of the inside of the palace, but it does show you quite a good sort of representation of the outside. So we're looking at a corner. So if this is the yellow gateway, we're looking at this corner here. And if we look here on the painting, we have these lotus petals on the outside, what appears to be the outside, but actually if we look on here, actually where they are is here. So it's kind of at the top of the wall. This is kind of a, I don't know what the word is, like an atrium, like a conservatory built on a roof. I don't know what the correct architectural word is one of those. But here we can see those lotus petals all the way around the wall. And then inside that, we have these triangular shapes. They're like we just flip over to here. Can't really see it on this photo. You can a bit there, actually. They're kind of stupas that kind of, again, go around the top section of the wall. And then we have this dark blue section. Let's come up here again. We have this dark blue section where we have these strings of jewels, which on here, you can see in here, kind of jeweled ornamentation. And again, actually below it, you also have this layer here as well of a jewel section, which on the painting is this orange level here. And then in between, on this one of flowers, which actually are on Andy's one here. I don't know if you can make this out. It's a little bit pixelated, but it's actually a goddess. Here's her feet, legs, torso, head here. And then she's actually an offering goddess, which on this one here, you can see they're actually standing, they're standing up on this one, but they're all kind of facing in towards the inside of the palace. And they're standing on this red section here, which corresponds with this red painted area. So this is kind of all the parts of the walls of the palace. Around the gates, this is the gate section here, which we'll come to in a minute. Around the gates, you can see the ends of a vajra.
No.
I did bring. Let's just see on my camera. There we have, for anyone who hasn't, try and bring it into the camera, a vajra. So you can probably see from the shape of the vajra what we're looking at on the. Oh, no, you're not seeing me, are you? No, that's right. Faye was just going to write me a note. Hello, I'm back. So that's a vajra. Okay, most of you will obviously have seen these from tantric practice before, but if you haven't, it's a ritual object which has great significance, great meaning, which is the subject of a another massively long course. But one of the things that it represents is indestructibility. And when we look on a mandala, let's come back to the mandala. Oh, there we go. So it's actually a crossed vajra. So you've got one section there and the lower section there. And then you've got another one going left to right. You've got one there and one over that side. So this kind of runs underneath the palace. On here, we can see, here it is here. So we can see three of the prongs, the vajra there, and another three there. And then there'll be obviously three more prongs over on the south side, and three more on the western side over here. So the whole palace is built on this crossed Vajra. We call the Vajra ground. It gives the whole palace its immutable or indestructible aspect or nature. Immovable, makes everything very strong. The gateway themselves, there are different designs of gate. Not going to go into too much detail. This is what's called an 11-level gateway. It's quite a standard look. This one here that I showed you earlier, this is also, is it 11 or is it 8? 1, 2, 3, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11. So this is also 11, but because the palace is so big, it's a much bigger palace. We haven't got room for the whole gate to go in the drawing. So we actually compress all the levels into this area. But there are also other, I don't have images available immediately, but we have 8-level gateways and probably 6-level, I think, as well, with different significance. But this is the most common. This is the one that you've seen almost all the time, is this 11-level gateway. Yeah, we'll have a look at some of the meaning of this in probably the next session. So that's the palace. So you have the deity in the center, the throne, and then the walls and the gateways and the entranceways of the palace. I haven't mentioned, actually, in these gateways, we have these symbols here. These are protecting deities. They're the guardians of the four doorways. For those who might know the four guardian kings, Dhritarashtra, Viradaka, Virupaksha, and Vaishravana, that's who these are. Maybe I'll try and find an image. These are kind of hand implements. That's their kind of abbreviated forms, in the same way that this seed syllable represents Waitara. These are the hand implements of these four guardian kings. So they're in a bigger mandala. You might actually find the whole guardian king actually painted in there. But this is, it's quite small. There's not enough room to paint. So we just put the hand implements in. Going outside of the palace into kind of the grounds, we have these vases with a tree, and we're getting really tiny. Okay, this white circle here, when I painted it, is probably only 3-4 millimeters across, maybe. So the fact that I've got 7 different colored dots in there is about as much detail as you can fit in with a paintbrush. It's actually what are called the 7 precious possessions of a king, which are a set of offerings that were traditionally offered to a great king, a great monarch, especially a Chakravartin king. Was kind of literally means a wheel-turning king, one who was very benevolent to their people. So yeah, they're kind of set here as being offerings. Then we have things like victory umbrella, proclaiming the victory of Dharma. We have again, we have offering goddesses floating in these clouds up here, and they're offering, this is actually a long life vase filled with nectar. And then as a kind of crowning ornament on the gate, we have the wheel of Dharma here, and these two deer who symbolize different things, but in this context, they're symbolizing the generation and completion stages of Tantra, which we'll talk about a little more later, another session. These here we've got emblems or symbols. So we have lotuses in the western direction, it's the emblem of Buddha Amitabha. So you have one either side. Over here there are swords, flaming swords, which are the emblem of Buddha Amoghasiddhi. The Dharma wheel here, symbol of Virachana. And over this side are the collection of jewels, the symbol of Ratnasambhava. So these Buddhas correspond with the colors that are present in each of the directions. So like on the Vajra, and inside the hallway, we have these various colors that represent the different Dhyani Buddhas, the five Buddhas, which we'll talk about really when we get to these flames on the outside. I promise you we'll talk about them there. So outside of the palace and its grounds, we come to kind of the edge, if you like, of the mandala. And we mentioned this morning about protection circles. And this is what encompasses the whole mandala. So the area outside of these circles, this kind of dark blue area, is we call the Dharma Dhatu, the disk of space, the potential for things to occur, if you like. And what has occurred is the mandala. That's what we've created out of the space of the Dharma Dhatu, which is kind of emptiness which hasn't taken form yet, if you like. In a direct translation of the word Dharma Dhatu, it can mean space, but it can also mean like a womb. So Dharma here is not used in the way of like the teachings of the Buddha are called the Dharma. Here the Dharma is translated as phenomena, things, stuff. So Dharma Dhatu is like the space of phenomena, or the space from which phenomena are born. This is what gives this sense of the womb. It's potential, it's a world of possibility. It's whatever we have the karma to experience arises out of the space of the Dharma Dhatu. And what has arisen, as I say, is the mandala and the deity within that space. So it's like saying, within the space of emptiness, we have created a world for ourselves. So what bounds or encompasses the whole mandala are these protection circles. What do we mean by protection circles? Well, so we call one of the alternative names for Vajrayana is the secret mantra yana. And mantra, really, we often use this as meaning kind of a recited set of words, like a small prayer or something that we use as mantra. But the real meaning of the word mantra is that we translate as mind protection. And especially in terms of the Vajrayana, what we'll be being protected from is this ordinary appearance and conception. These are the, like we say, this is the ground, this is the view of the Tantrayana, that it is ordinary appearance and conception that is the root of samsara, that is the source of all of our suffering. So we are engaging in this practice in order to protect our minds from suffering and its cause, or we can say protecting our minds from ordinary appearance and conception. So we meditate on the mandala and the deity very strongly so that this becomes the appearance. And there are stories in the tantric literature of the two stories that have sprung out to me while I've been sort of doing background for this teaching. There's a deity called Yamantaka, who is like a very wrathful buffalo-headed deity who has these pointy horns. And the story is that there was a practitioner of this deity, Yamantaka, whose total belief in his appearance as Yamantaka and not in his ordinary human form, he was so convinced that that's what he looked like, that as he went in through a doorway, he would duck his head so that his horns wouldn't catch on the top of the doorway. He was that convinced. I mean, we might think that's crazy. We might think, oh, he's just making it up kind of thing. But no, if we have absolute certainty in our meditation on being the deity, then this is what's going to happen. Another story I read just now was a deity called Hevajra, who is, I think he's got 16 arms. And there was a student who was given this practice to do, and he became very advanced, really believed that he had 16 arms. But his problem was that he developed a lot of pride. He was obviously so good at his practice that actually he became sort of very, very proud of his achievement. Now, his teacher, who was an enlightened being, saw that his disciple had developed a lot of pride. So he thought, I'll go and visit him in his cave. Arrived at the cave, and the disciple was very happy to see his teacher. And the teacher said, oh, look, I've been traveling a long way. Would you mind washing my feet? And the disciple said, of course, that would be fine. So as the disciple was washing the feet, the master manifested two extra feet. So he had 4 feet. And the disciple was like, oh, I'm okay, I can do this. I've got 16 arms. I can wash 4 feet all at the same time. So then the master doubled it again. He had 8 feet. And the disciple was like, hey, not a problem. I've got 16 arms. I can wash all your 8 feet all at the same time. And of course, he doubled it again to get you 16. He thought, yeah, I'm still fine. And then, of course, the master manifested another 16 feet, 32 feet. And the disciple was like, ah, problem. And it kind of showed him that actually his meditation, he was very convinced that his 16 arms were genuine. But he'd kind of stopped there because his pride had held him back from being more open. There wasn't that open quality to his meditation. He'd probably forgotten the emptiness aspect. As I say, if we don't remember the emptiness aspect when we meditate on the deity in the mandala, then this is one of the dangers, is that we can develop just very ordinary delusion about our meditation, and that can include developing pride. So the teacher was there obviously to show the error of his ways, and the disciple understood that he developed pride and was able then to break through it and continue his meditation in a much more beneficial way. But these show that we can become really convinced of our non-ordinary appearance. If we meditate very, very strongly on ourselves as being the deity, then we can become, this can become not only how things appear, but how we conceive of them as well. So this is this thing about overcoming ordinary appearance and conception. I think they say early on, it's more important that we work with ordinary conception, that we try to break down our ordinary conception, because that's actually easier. It's very difficult for us to be convinced by ourselves appearing either in the form of a deity or within a mandala, our world, our totality of vision being in the form of a mandala. Sure, we try to meditate on this, we imagine it in meditation, but to really be convinced that it's real, that's quite difficult from appearance point of view. So they say it's more important early on that we just keep reminding ourselves that things don't exist in the way they appear, because we still continue to see things in an ordinary way. We still see our ordinary body, we still see our ordinary environment, but we should definitely focus on trying to stop ordinary conception, not assenting to or believing those things to be real in the way that they appear. That is something that we can do straight away. So that's something that's pointed to by these protection circles. It's a very long-winded way of talking about protection circles. Like I said, there's so much to explain. It's the entirety of Buddha's teachings. So I don't want to apologize, but I am going to apologize that there's just so much to talk about in trying to understand something on this scale. It's so vast. So there's a lot of talking involved. But we will look in quite a lot of detail actually at these three protection circles, because they're something that we can approach quite easily. So especially in the Gelug tradition, from which most of my teachings have come, that the school of Tibet, a very great tantric yogi. He's often billed as being a great scholar, and indeed he was, 200 volumes or so of written works, great scholar. But actually he spent most of his life practicing tantra. That of those 200 volumes, most of them are actually on tantra, about two-thirds or more. So a very great tantric yogi as well. And he put forward that it was the most important thing for us as an entryway to Tantra was to have at least a good grounding in what he called the three principal aspects of the path. Which were renunciation, compassion, and wisdom. And these are these three protection circles. So these, this ring of lotuses, sorry, I've just covered my microphone with a bit of paper. This ring of lotuses represents renunciation. That's the meaning of these. We can say even that each of these lotus petals is one of the vows that we take. So there are many, I think there are 64 lotus petals around here, but it's just symbolic of the many, many vows that we take. And this represents renunciation. So this is, in terms of the three turnings of the wheel of Dharma, this especially is taught in the first turning on the Hinayana path. Renunciation is an attitude that rejects ordinary life and wants for ourselves something more, something long-term happiness. So this can be on different levels. We can say that we can strive to achieve happiness in future lives. This is kind of the first level. Notice not happiness in this life. That does not constitute a spiritual path. At the very least, and this is what the first turning of the wheel of Dharma really offers, is a method by which we can stop the causes of future suffering. In the Lam Rim teachings, this corresponds with the small scope, the first scope of the Lam Rim, whereby we try to eradicate the causes for lower rebirth, that we would only from now on take higher rebirth. And we are working to achieve that by removing the causes of rebirth in the lower realms. On another level, we can say renunciation is turning away from, I think I've used the translation definite emergence, okay, for the Tibetan term for renunciation, which completely escapes me. I've completely forgotten it. But we can stop wanting samsara to work. It's not going to work. It's always going to lead to suffering in samsara. So on this next level of renunciation, we're not just looking for higher rebirth within samsara. We're looking for all samsaric rebirth to stop. This is this level of liberation, nirvana. Our own individual liberation. So this is really what this protection circle is protecting us from samsaric rebirth. So it's an attitude, it's addressing a motivation for us to be determined, not just that we should be creating causes for immediate happiness or for future happiness in this life, or even just bringing lower rebirth to an end. What we're looking for here is to bring all samsaric rebirth to an end. So in this way, it provides protection, because even higher rebirth in samsara will eventually, the causes that led us, say, to the God realms, even though we may live for thousands of human years in complete and utter luxury and, you know, sort of with almost no suffering at all until the very end of our lives, even that has to come to an end. Once those causes are exhausted, that life will come to an end, and we will then suffer rebirth, probably in one of the low realms, as an animal, as a hungry spirit, or as a hell being. So even higher rebirth in samsara is not something that is satisfactory. It's a sticking plaster, and it's a worthy aim as a very initial thing. But the real protection comes from breaking free from samsara completely. Now, this is what we mean by renunciation. It's turning away from trying to make samsara work, turning away from being happy to just work for higher rebirth or even immediate happiness, and turning towards, and this is this idea of definite emergence. Okay, we are, we're making a determination to emerge from an ordinary set of values and striving instead for something that is pure by nature and is a cessation in that way of the Four Noble Truths, of true cessations. This will be a true cessation of samsaric rebirth. So this is this first protection circle, renunciation. The second one is a string of vajras, some of which we see side on. So we can kind of see the vajra here. Actually, if I go to there we go. Yeah. So there's a much better picture of a vajra. This one's side on. These are kind of used to represent you're actually looking down onto the point of the vajra. And they're all different sizes of vajras in there as well. They form a completely impenetrable barrier. All the vajras kind of fit together so that there are no intervening spaces left. So even in these tiny spaces in here, there would be more vajras. And right into here, all the space would be occupied by vajras. You can't depict that graphically. So we use this technique. Doing some side on, looking at some sort of from the top, and then putting lines in to say this is continuous, there's a continuity here, an unbroken continuity. So what do the vajras represent? Well, it's the second of the three, where it's gone, principal aspects. Compassion. So what does this protect us against? In terms of protection circles, what does compassion protect us from? It protects us from working merely for our own liberation. So this is the real meaning of the Mahayana, is to encompass the welfare of all living beings. So we develop great compassion That's compassion for all living beings. And we take the Bodhisattva vows, through which we promise to work for the benefit of other sentient beings. How do we do that? We practice the six perfections. This is how we can enact or put into action these teachings on compassion. As I say, this provides protection from this mind that only works for our own benefit. We can also say that this protects us from all forms of harm. So if we have the welfare of all living beings in the center of our motivation, of our practice, then, as it says in the Lama Chöpa, practice, even if all the beings of the three realms rise up against me as my enemies, we say this, and also whether they criticize me, harm me, kill me, that we will only act positively in return because of our attitude, our very special attitude of bodhicitta, because of our great compassion. We don't perceive harm. Even when beings act in harmful ways, we don't take it as harm to ourselves. We see it as their suffering. And if not immediate suffering, we see it as that they are causing themselves suffering for the future. So this only increases our compassion, which again is a very great protection for our mind. It stops us from getting angry, getting jealous, all these negative things that might otherwise occur. So on the outside of the mandala, we have these five, let's just get all five visible. We have these five colored flames going round the outside of the mandala. And this is the third of the three principal aspects, which is ultimate bodhicitta or wisdom, teachings on wisdom. So the fact that it is a flame is twofold, that we can say that the flame is that which burns up delusion, especially ignorance. Or we can say that the flame lights the darkness of ignorance. These are the two kind of symbolic ways. Do we have? No. Oh, actually, yeah. If we come back here, there we go. I was looking for a sword, and there's one. So this is Jeton Kapa, the founder of the Gelug tradition, and in his right hand, he has a lotus flower upon which is a sword, which has this flame around it. So this is the sword of wisdom, and it cuts through ignorance. But we always have this flame around it. And it's for these sort of two ways in which I just said that we can either say that the flame lights the darkness of ignorance, or that it burns away the delusion of ignorance. That's why this is represented as a flame. So these are the five wisdoms. Okay, these five different colors, what we call the five wisdoms. And they are, again, part of our Buddha nature. These five wisdoms already exist within our Buddha nature. They are one of the main components of what we call the enlightened qualities that are present already within our Buddha nature. I think tomorrow we can talk a bit more about the five Buddha families. Again, these, I said earlier about these four different directions and four different colors. There's also one in the center. Okay, so making five, four directions and one in the center as making five. And these represent the five Buddha families, part of which each of the Buddha families has a different type of wisdom associated with it. And on the outside of the mandala, these five colored flames represent these five different types of wisdom. So what does wisdom protect us against? Right. Wisdom protects us against mistaken view, ignorance. Fundamental ignorance is just merely that we just make this really quite simple mistake. This is why it's got, I think, called fundamental ignorance. It's actually really quite a simple mistake that what we perceive, whether that be what we call ourself or the world around us or other, we don't only see the object, we see that object as being inherently existent. We just make this really simple mistake that things, we think they exist in the way that they appear. And the Buddha's teachings on wisdom completely try to point us in the direction of the actual way in which things exist and not just the way in which they appear. So this is wisdom and ignorance. Ignorance of the way in which things truly exist and the wisdom of the way in which things truly exist. And one obviously overturns the other. So this wisdom is the ultimate protection. It's the very thing that brings about our awakening, our complete fulfillment of our Buddha nature, is this seeing how things really exist. When we have that, we have no ignorance. And without ignorance, we don't see duality of the self and other. And without duality, then we don't develop craving. We don't develop anger because there is no more sense of self and other. And without ignorance, without craving, without anger, these are the three root delusions, then we don't develop any of the other delusions either. Jealousy, pride, avarice, miserliness, all these different negative emotions. They all arise on the basis of either ignorance, anger, or attachment. And without ignorance, none of them will arise. So it is the ultimate protection. And I say it gives the space in which our Buddha nature can come to its full ripening. Our innate qualities of enlightenment can manifest. So this is the pinnacle of the path. We can break things down a bit more tomorrow. But there you have an overview of a mandala. I say we'll go into a bit more detail tomorrow. Just going to see on here. So you can, on this three-dimensional image, we can just see the lotus petals here. We have vajras in there, and then we have the flames here. Hopefully that's a little bit helpful in seeing. I think we're all quite used to, or hopefully all of us are quite used to kind of seeing two-dimensional mandalas. But to actually transform our understanding of two dimensions into three dimensions can be quite difficult. And if you do get the opportunity to see a three-dimensional mandala, spend some time with it if you have the opportunity. If you ever see one, go to a temple somewhere and they've got a three-dimensional model of a mandala, really spend some time with it. Try and sort of imprint it on your mind, because this two-dimensional representation, it's a good aid memoir, but it doesn't give you sort of so much in the way of what you're trying to actually visualize in your meditation. So it's a really good idea to study the three-dimensional mandala. Get on Google, see what you can find on Google Images. I found this image years ago, so I can't remember where I got it from, but I'm pretty sure it was just on the internet somewhere. Just type in maybe three-dimensional mandalas, Buddhist, see what you can find. These corner pieces are just merely decoration. That's just to fill in some space around the outside. This one, Andy Weber's one, we've got a bit of landscape going on, which is quite nice. But then more specifically, he's included here some important figures from the Buddhist tradition, just to help us develop faith and devotion. They're not really an implicit part of the mandala itself, but they're there to augment or enhance the image. But you may well come across mandalas that have maybe long sort of lists of lineage gurus or other deities around who might kind of be associated with the central deity. I'm just trying to give you some sort of sense of what you might find and what you might kind of understand for yourself when you're seeing pictures of mandalas. We've gone through all the essential features, but there might also be, you know, sort of extra bits around the outside, but they never really form part of the mandala. The mandala stops at this ring of fire. In some mandalas, and I don't really want to go into this at all, but for instance, on this three-dimensional mandala, around here are what are called the charnel grounds. There we go. Sorry, yes, it was taking a while to catch up. So on this three-dimensional mandala, we have these right at the outside. So see, the flames are inside. And then on the outside, we have what are called the eight charnel grounds, which I'm not going to go into. But they also form part of the mandala. They are also a protection circle. And for those of you who practice highest yoga tantra, you may have come across those for yourself. But I'm not going to go into them here. So we've got about 20 minutes left. I'm just going to stop the screen share. Yeah, there we go. Which is good timing because it was just coming to a standstill. I'd actually changed the image and you couldn't see that. So something's going on with Zoom. I'm going to invite questions and don't feel that they need to be directly about what we've been talking about this afternoon. Iconography is a huge subject and everybody always asks me, what does this mean? What does that mean? Please feel free. If you have questions on what we've been covering today, that's great. But equally, if you've got any burning questions, then please go ahead and ask. And I can see, Deki Lee, you have a question.
Yes, I do. Thank you very much. Just as you were explaining the different levels of the protection, you were talking about the lotus level of the renunciation. And we're talking about the first turning, et cetera. So the lower scope part and then swung into the medium scope, which was turning from definite emergence. And the liberation in nirvana, which would be medium scope. Because I have been working with something called the 16 Guidelines for Life, which is with Alison Murdoch.
Yes.
The question was, is turning from definite emergence turning from much of the lower scope intentions, which is ethics for happiness in this life, the 16 human dharmas, which King Sungsun Gampo initiated, you know, as political principles for a whole new Tibetan nation. Mm-hmm. So then I guess my question is, in essence, are we, when we're turning to from definite emergence, are we literally turning from the lower scope teachings? Or are we using it as a foundation? It's kind of a question of where's that balance?
Okay.
Or are the lower scope preparing us to be able to do what we do in the medium scope?
Okay. So I think in terms of the three yanas, if we look at Hinayana, Mahayana, Vajrayana, the Hinayana, which is principally taken from the first turning teachings, I always translate, I know there's been a tradition that we call it the lesser vehicle or the small vehicle. And I think this was often used as a way of saying it's not the best, you know, it's kind of some bit of substandard teaching. And I think it's really important we don't have this attitude, because the Hinayana for me, the translation that I find the best is that it is the foundation vehicle. And if we want to think of ourselves as Mahayana or Vajrayana practitioners, that we really, the teachings from the Hinayana are in no way to be rejected or abandoned or gone beyond. Right up until enlightenment, they are absolutely essential. So especially teachings on impermanence and death, for instance, which come from principally from the first turning. The classic quote from the Lam Rim is that meditation on death and impermanence is important at the start, in the middle, and at the end. So that understanding of how important it is for us to have a very deep realization of impermanence and death continues throughout our spiritual career. But it's not something...
So what's the implication of turning from definite emergence in relation to it?
For me, definite emergence or renunciation is...
in relation to that second scope.
Yes, yeah. It's really, it's renouncing any samsaric rebirth.
But isn't
sorry on the second on the middle scope, it is going further than that. It's saying, I think there's a little bit of confusion about maybe I said the wrong thing in the teaching, that the small scope, medium scope, and great scope don't necessarily equate with the three turnings or the three yanas. So maybe I shouldn't have used the words lower scope. That's from the Lam Rim. So in the, even in the Hinayana, the possibility of there being liberation from samsara, from any samsaric rebirth, is possible. We can become an arhat, whereby we achieve liberation from samsara. So that's on the Hinayana level. So in the Lam Rim, the small scope, sorry, I'm just checking in my mind, trying to make sure that I'm saying the right thing here.
That's okay. We can dance. Don't worry.
No, the small scope is individual liberation. So that does include that up to and including individual liberation. And actually, even because in the model of the three, or in even more clearly on the model of the nine yanas. So those of you are aware of the nine-pronged vajra, instead of a five-pronged vajra, you get the nine prongs. And the nine prongs represent nine yanas. And in here we have, according to the Hinayana, we have the path of hearers, Shravakas, and Pratyeka Buddhas. And on the Pratyeka Buddha path, which is still part of the Hinayana, but they already have some notion of emptiness beyond selflessness of the Hinayana, what we traditionally call Hinayana, of this absence of a self, anatman, that the Pratyeka Buddhas actually have already moved their view a bit further forward and include some idea of there being some external phenomena of also being, of having a lack of inherent existence. So yes, the Hinayana and the small scope both teach the ability to break free completely from samsara. So I think what I was saying about renunciation, that there was a level of renunciation that is renouncing samsaric happiness, in that the Hinayana teachings can also lead you to merely, and I say this merely, but I wish I had it myself, the ability to avoid future lower rebirth. So not breaking free from samsara, but using the teachings from the Hinayana, we can achieve the state where we would sort of take higher rebirth in the future, but probably not forever.
Yeah.
So I think there's maybe, I think I maybe kind of introduced a little bit of confusion in there. Right. Does that answer that?
Let me sit with it for a while and I'll let it all digest.
Okay. I'm sorry, I'm not so familiar with the 16 guidelines, so I can't kind of talk in that sort of language about where it would fit in with 16 guidelines. It's not
It would be the 16 human dharmas by King Sangsten Gampo, which was a set of ethics that he brought into the country, Buddhist ethics,
right,
that he used to transform, to pull together all of Tibet, which was very Mongolian, Genghis Khan-ish, and turn it into the peaceful nation that he's, you know, has survived until now.
Yes.
So that would definitely be small scope teachings.
Okay. Yeah, I suppose if it's like focusing on ethical behavior, then that's certainly
ethical behaviors, but it was for happiness for this life. But I think underlying it for him, he knew because of Buddhism that he was setting up his people to have positive future rebirths.
Yes. Yes. Yeah. Yeah. We've all got to start somewhere. And as I said before, if people can't, they don't have the vision to take on those sort of higher ideals of, you know, bringing an end to samsaric rebirth, to full enlightenment, or if you don't have the capacity for that, then working for the happiness, just a bit of happiness, that's a good thing.
So you it's what I'd say. He was bringing in the sacred, the sneaky sacred.
Yes. Yes. Yeah. 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 Good way of putting it. Yeah.
Okay. Thank you. That. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Anybody else? Don't hold back. There may be one on the chat. Let's have a look. Okay, so somebody's asked, is there a specific order that a mandala is painted in? There are different traditions. So in one tradition, you would begin by painting the seed syllable of the deity onto a kind of blank canvas. You might have just put in construction lines just to show exactly where the center is going to be. And then you might paint in just the seed syllable of the deity, quite often in real gold as well. And then you would paint everything on the top of that. In another tradition, you actually leave the central position blank until right at the end. You paint the deity in at the end. So there are different traditions, is the answer to that one. Sort of generally speaking as well, you can work either sort of from the center outwards. So all those different parts of the mandala that we looked at, or the other way around, that you start with the outside and you work in. I don't think it's not a random process, and it's not a paint a bit of that and then a bit of this. Then there are also considerations from a purely practical, being an artist, point of view of, if you mix up a particular shade of paint, you will probably paint it in every place where that color occurs. I'm just thinking that's probably not so true about mandalas. It's more universally true about painting deities, where if you've mixed up a particular shade of blue, that you would paint all of the blue bits, or all those bits that use that color, you would paint all those at one time. But it's, even then, it's not definite. When painting a deity, you generally start in the background, especially with the sky, and then work forwards in the composition. So you do the most distant things first: sky, landscape, say mountains, then hills in front, then water in front of that, clouds, then kind of the lotus, and then the deity will be the last thing you'll paint, because it's the most forward thing in the composition. So there are different ways of going about painting orders. Right, the other question we have concerns the charnel grounds. As I say, I don't really want to go too far in that direction. I think you're pointing towards there being some mandalas have the charnel grounds on the very outside, so outside of the flame circle, and in other mandalas the flames appear inside. I don't think it's appropriate for me to comment too much on that because I'm, to be honest, don't really know too much about it. I have my own practice and I know where the charnel grounds occur, but it's not something that I've used to compare to other practices. So maybe if you were to check in a detailed commentary to the practice that you refer to, then hopefully you would find an answer there, or maybe to approach sort of one of the teachers who, yes, you've just put it in the message. yes, Andy Wistrick would be an ideal person to ask about the answer to that question. Yeah. Okay. Nothing else on chat. Is there anything? Oh, yes, Anne. Was that you putting your hand up, Anne? Oh, yes.
I was trying to mute. Sorry.
Yes, that's okay.
Bits and pieces, real bits okay. and pieces.
All right.
When you're sort of in your mind, I don't know if this is within the realms of what you're doing here, but when you're expanding it out from two dimensional to three in your mind, obviously everything becomes three dimensional. But when you have that white Tara mandala of the auspicious symbols around, would they still be flat on the floor or would they become three dimensional?
They would, in my understanding, they would be standing up around you.
So okay, they would be, not as two dimensional standing up, actually three dimensional.
Three dimensional standing up.
Okay, yes. So everything becomes three dimensional. Yeah, yeah.
Yes. Okay. Yeah. So for instance, in that case, the conch shell would be, you know, sort of stood up, but three dimensional in itself as well. But
what about the endless knot? How does that work?
Yeah, that works. Yeah, yeah, yeah. Normally it's got a diagonal point at the bottom, and normally they will put a little lotus flower for it for the point to rest on.
It is, it's lovely. The other thing is your blue line drawer, what is that? Is that Medicine Buddha?
It is, yes.
Okay. Yeah. And the other thing is, I've got a couple of things. I've got a cross vajra. I think you might want to see it.
Oh, great. There we go. So especially people who might not have seen cross vajra before. There we go. And very helpfully has a cross vajra.
It was very helpfully in a tub, rambled enough once, you know, as they do. Okay. The other thing is, what else? Oh, charnel grounds, I was going to ask, you've done that one. The colours of the paints. I mean, I'm sure you know this, but you use film canisters nowadays, don't you? If you get film canisters, you put your colour and your paint in there and you can keep it indefinitely.
Yeah, with acrylics, six months.
And then I use gouache.
Then they start with the gouache, yeah, because then you can reconstitute them. Yes.
Yeah, I just think if somebody is going to be doing this, it's worth knowing that, because I was a few years not knowing that.
Right.
It was very useful when I found it out.
Yeah. I used to have, the chrysanthemum dishes, porcelain palettes, and I just used to, with gouache, used to let those just dry out and put a bit of cling film over them so they didn't get dusty. And then just reuse it. Yeah. So.
Okay. Thank you. I think that's all. Thank you.
Okay. So it is 4:00. We have Tim. You need to unmute yourself, Tim. Hello. Have we got him?
There we go. Hi, can you hear me?
Yes, we've got you now.
I can save it for tomorrow. I didn't realise what time it was. It's just a generic question, so I can save it for tomorrow. If it's we're at 4:00, aren't we? So I don't want to go over time.
No? Okay, sure. Save it for tomorrow.
Okay.
We'll cover it then. Yep, lovely.
Great. All right, thank you.
Okay, so once again, we should just take a moment to really rejoice. What an amazing opportunity. I mean, it still gets me just all the time of there was me, you come from a just such an ordinary background, for no reason at all have met this amazing and precious Dharma, that has given the opportunity to really develop in so many ways, helpful to myself, working on trying to become a better person for others, trying to cause less harm, we really need to take the essence of this opportunity that we have and apply it in all situations at all times. We don't know how long that we will continue to have this opportunity. There are no guarantees for the future. We should be immensely grateful to all of our gurus, our teachers. We don't do this on our own. So great teachers such as His Holiness the Dalai Lama, so inspiring that we can become just like them. We should develop determination to continue to work to the best of our capacity and knowledge to be of benefit to all living beings. And may all the merit and virtue we might have created today through engaging with the Dharma, viewing holy images, all the blessings we might have received, we dedicate all this to the welfare of all living beings. And we swiftly become guru deities ourselves, and then lead every living being without exception to that same state and bring samsara to an end. So thank you very, very much. Thank you so much for coming. We start again the same time, 10 o'clock in the morning. More of the same.